It goes from an assumption to an origin or first principle, which is free from assumptions. It does not use the images which the first part uses, but makes its way in the investigation using forms alone, through themselves alone. I don't entirely follow what you just said. Let's try again. You'll find it easier when you've heard what I have to say by way of introduction. You're aware, I imagine, that when people are doing things like geometry and arithmetic, there are some things they take for granted in their respective disciplines. Odd and even, figures, and the three types of angle, that sort of thing. Taking these as known, they make them into assumptions. They see no need to justify them either to themselves or to anyone else. They regard them as plain to anyone. Starting from these, they then go through the rest of their argument and finally reach, by agreed steps, that which they set out to investigate. "Yes, I'm aware of that," he said. "And you will also be aware that they summon up the assistance of visible forms and refer their discussion to them, although they're not thinking about these, but about the things these are images of. So their reasoning has in view the square itself and the diagonal itself, not the diagonal they have drawn. And the same with other examples. The models they construct, or figures they draw, which have their own shadows and images in water, these they treat in their turn as images in their attempt to see the corresponding things themselves, which can be seen only by thought." "True. That is why I described this category as grasped by the understanding, but as requiring for its investigation that the soul make use of assumptions. The soul cannot make any progress towards a first principle, since it is unable to escape from these assumptions and move in an upwards direction. Instead, it treats as images the things which were treated as originals and copied by what was in the section below them, and which are thought of as clear, by comparison with those images, and valued for their clarity." "I see," he said. "You mean the realm of geometry and its related disciplines." "Finally, by the other section of the line representing the objects of understanding, you must take me to mean what reason itself grasps by its power to conduct a rational discussion, when it uses assumptions not as first principles, but as true bases, points to take off from, entry points, until it gets to what is free from assumptions and arrives at the origin or first principle of everything. This it seizes hold of, then turns round and follows the things which follow from this first principle, and so makes its way down to an end point. It makes no use at all of any object of the senses, but only of pure forms, working through them and towards them, and it ends in forms." "I sort of see," he said, "though not as well as I'd like. I think what you're talking about is an enormous task, but I do at least understand that you want to take that which is and is understood and distinguish that part of it which is studied by the knowledge which comes from rational discussion as something clearer than the part which is studied by what are called the sciences. These use assumptions as first principles, and although those who study them are compelled to use thinking rather than their senses to do so, still, because their investigation does not make its way upwards to a first principle, but proceeds from assumptions, you do not regard them as having an intelligent understanding of their subjects, although with a first principle they could be understood. I also think that when people are doing subjects like geometry, you call their state of mind thought, rather than understanding, because you regard thought as a halfway house between opinion and understanding." "You've grasped my meaning well enough," I said, "and please understand that there are four conditions arising in the soul, corresponding to the four sections of the line. Understanding corresponds to the highest section, thought to the second, belief to the third, and conjecture to the last. Classify them accordingly, believing that the degree of clarity they possess is proportional to the truth possessed by their objects. I understand, I agree, and I classify them in the way you suggest." If we are thinking about the effect of education, or the lack of it, on our nature, there's another comparison we can make. Picture human beings living in some sort of underground cave dwelling, with an entrance which is long, as wide as the cave, and open to the light. Here they live from earliest childhood, with their legs and necks in chains, so that they have to stay where they are, looking only ahead of them, prevented by the chains from turning their heads. They have light from a distant fire, which is burning behind them and above them. Between the fire and the prisoners, at a higher level than them, is a path, along which you must picture a low wall that has been built, like the screen which hides people when they're giving a puppet show, and above which they make the puppets appear. "Yes, I can picture all that," he said. "Picture also, along the length of the wall, people carrying all sorts of manufactured objects which project above it, statues of people, animals made of stone and wood, and all kinds of materials. As you'd expect, some of the people carrying the objects are speaking while others are silent. A strange picture, and strange prisoners. No more strange than us," I said. "Do you think for a start that prisoners of that sort have ever seen anything more of themselves and of one another than the shadows cast by the fire on the wall of the cave in front of them? How could they, if they'd been prevented from moving their heads all their lives? What about the objects which are being carried? Wouldn't they see only shadows of these also?" "Yes, of course. So, if they were able to talk to one another, don't you think they'd believe that the things they were giving names to were the things they could see passing?" "Yes, they'd be bound to." "What if the prison had an echo from the wall in front of them? Every time one of the people passing by spoke, do you suppose they'd believe the source of the sound to be anything other than the passing shadow?" "No, that's exactly what they would think." "All in all, then, what people in this situation would take for truth would be nothing more than the shadows of the manufactured objects. Necessarily. Suppose nature brought this state of affairs to an end," I said. "Think what their release from their chains and the cure for their ignorance would be like. When one of them was untied and compelled suddenly to stand up, turn his head, start walking and look towards the light, he'd find all these things painful. Because of the glare, he'd be unable to see things whose shadows he used to see before. What do you suppose he'd say if he was told that what he used to see before was of no importance, whereas now his eyesight was better, since he was closer to what is, and looking at things which more truly are? Suppose further that each of the passing objects was pointed out to him, and that he was asked what it was and compelled to answer. Don't you think he'd be confused? Wouldn't he believe the things he saw before to be more true than what was being pointed out to him now?" "Yes, he would. Much more true. If he was forced to look at the light itself, wouldn't it hurt his eyes? Wouldn't he turn away and run back to the things he could see? Wouldn't he think those things really were clearer than what was being pointed out?" "Yes," he said. "And if he was dragged out of there by force, up the steep and difficult path, with no pause until he'd been dragged right into the sunlight, wouldn't he find this dragging painful? Wouldn't he resent it? And when he came into the light, with his eyes filled with the glare, would he be able to see a single one of the things people call real?" "No, he wouldn't. Not at first. He'd need to acclimatise himself, I imagine, if he were going to see things up there. To start with, he'd find shadows the easiest things to look at. After that, reflections of people and other things in water. The things themselves would come later, and from those he would move on to the heavenly bodies and the heavens themselves. He'd find it easier to look at the light of the stars and the moon by night than look at the sun and the light of the sun by day. Of course. The last thing he'd be able to look at, presumably, would be the sun. Not its image in water or some location that is not its own, but the sun itself. He'd be able to look at it by itself, in its own place, and see it as it really was. Yes, he said, that would unquestionably be the last thing he'd be able to look at. At that point he would work out that it was the sun which caused the seasons and the years, which governed everything in the visible realm, and which was, in one way or another, responsible for everything they used to see. That would obviously be the next stage. Now, suppose he were reminded of the place where he lived originally, of what passed for wisdom there, and of his former fellow prisoners. Don't you think he would congratulate himself on the change? Wouldn't he feel sorry for them? Indeed, he would. Back in the cave, they might have had rewards and praises and prizes for the person who was quickest at identifying the passing shapes, who had the best memory for the ones which came earlier or later or simultaneously, and who, as a result, was best at predicting what was going to come next. Do you think he would feel any desire for these prizes? Would he envy those who were respected and powerful there? Or would he feel as Achilles does in Homer? Would he much prefer to labour as a common serf, serving a man with nothing to his name, putting up with anything to avoid holding those opinions and living that life? Yes, he said. If you ask me, he'd be prepared to put up with anything to avoid that way of life. There's another question I'd like to ask you, I said. Suppose someone like that came back down into the cave and took up his old seat. Wouldn't he find, coming straight in from the sunlight, that his eyes were swamped by the darkness? I'm sure he would. And suppose he had to go back to distinguishing the shadows in competition with those who had never stopped being prisoners. Before his eyes had grown accustomed to the dark, while he still couldn't see properly, and this period of acclimatization would be anything but short, wouldn't he be a laughingstock? Wouldn't it be said of him that he'd come back from his journey to the upper world with his eyesight destroyed, and that it wasn't worth even trying to go up there? As for anyone who tried to set them free and take them up there, if they could somehow get their hands on him and kill him, wouldn't they do just that? They certainly would, he said. That is the picture, then, my dear Glaucon, and it fits what we were talking about earlier in its entirety. The region revealed to us by sight is the prison dwelling, and the light of the fire inside the dwelling is the power of the sun. If you identify the upward path and the view of things above with the ascent of the soul to the realm of understanding, then you will have caught my drift, my surmise, which is what you wanted to hear. Whether it is really true, perhaps only God knows. My own view, for what it's worth, is that in the realm of what can be known, the thing seen last, and seen with great difficulty, is the form or character of the good. But when it is seen, the conclusion must be that it turns out to be the cause of all that is right and good for everything. In the realm of sight, it produces light, and light's sovereign, the sun. While in the realm of thought, it is itself sovereign, producing truth and reason unassisted. I further believe that anyone who's going to act wisely, either in private life or in public life, must have had a sight of this form of the good. Well, I for one agree with you, he said, as far as I can follow, at any rate. Can you agree with me, then, on one further point? It's no wonder if those who have been to the upper world refuse to take an interest in everyday affairs, if their souls are constantly eager to spend their time in that upper region. It's what you'd expect, presumably, if things really are like the picture we've just drawn. Yes, it's what you'd expect. And here's another question. Do you think it's at all surprising if a person who turns to everyday life, after the contemplation of the divine, cuts a sorry figure and makes a complete fool of himself? If before he can see properly, or can get acclimatized to the darkness around him, he is compelled to compete, in the law courts or anywhere else, about the shadows of justice, or the statues which cast those shadows, or to argue about the way they are understood by those who have never seen justice itself. No, it's not in the least surprising, he said. Anyone with any sense, I said, would remember that people's eyesight can be impaired in two quite different ways, and for two quite different reasons. There's the change from light to darkness, and the change from darkness to light. He might then take it that the same is true of the soul, so that when he saw a soul in difficulties, unable to see, he would not laugh mindlessly, but would ask whether it had come from some brighter life and could not cope with the unfamiliar darkness, or whether it had come from greater ignorance into what was brighter and was now dazzled by the glare. One he would congratulate on what it had seen and on its way of life, the other he would pity, or if he chose to laugh at it, his laughter would be less absurd than laughter directed at the soul which had come from the light above. Yes, what you say is entirely reasonable. Well, I said, if it's true, there's one conclusion we can't avoid. Education is not what some people proclaim it to be. What they say, roughly speaking, is that they are able to put knowledge into souls where none was before, like putting sight into eyes which were blind. Yes, that is what they say. Whereas our present account indicates that this capacity in every soul, this instrument by means of which each person learns, is like an eye which can only be turned away from the darkness and towards the light by turning the whole body. The entire soul has to turn with it, away from what is coming to be, until it is able to bear the sight of what is, and in particular, the brightest part of it. This is the part we call the good, isn't it? Yes. It is up to us, then, as founders of the city, to compel the best natures to get as far as that study which we said earlier was the most important, to make that ascent and view the good. And when they have made it, and seen all they need to see, we must not allow them to do what they are allowed to do at the moment. What is that? Remain there, I said, and refuse to come back down again to the prisoners we were talking about, or share in their hardships and rewards, be they trivial or substantial. That seems very unfair. Are we going to make them live a worse life when it is in their power to live a better one? Now it's your turn to have forgotten, my friend, that the law does not exist for the exclusive benefit of one class in the city. Its aim is to engineer the benefit of the city as a whole, using persuasion and compulsion to bring the citizens into harmony and making each class share with the other classes the contribution it is able to bring to the community. The law is what puts people like this in the city, and it does so not with the intention of allowing each of them to go his own way, but so that it can make use of them for its own purposes, to bind the city together. True, he said, I had forgotten that. In which case, Glaucon, you should bear in mind that we won't after all be doing an injustice to those who become philosophers in our city. There will be justice in what we say to them, when we compel them to look after and guard what belongs to other people. It is fair enough, we shall say to them, for philosophers in other cities not to take a share of the work in those cities. Their philosophy is a spontaneous growth which arises despite the institutions of the particular city they live in, and what has developed naturally, indebted to nobody for its upbringing, is entitled to be unenthusiastic about paying anyone for its upbringing. But with you, it's different. We produced you as guides and rulers, both to yourselves and to the rest of the city, like leaders or kings in a hive of bees. You have been better and more fully educated than the rest, and are better able to play your part in both types of life, so you must go down, each of you in turn, to join the others in their dwelling place. You must get used to seeing in the dark, and when you do get used to it, you will see 1,000 times better than the people there do. You will be able to identify all the images there, and know what they are images of, since you have seen the truth of what is beautiful and just and good. In this way, the government of the city, for us and for you, will be a waking reality, rather than the kind of dream in which most cities exist nowadays, governed by people fighting one another over shadows and quarrelling with one another about ruling, as if ruling were some great good. The truth is, I imagine, that the city in which those who are to rule are most reluctant to do so will inevitably be the city which has the best and most stable government, whereas the city with rulers of the opposite kind will have a government of the opposite kind. Exactly, he said. Will they disobey us then, do you think, these people we have brought up? Will they refuse to do their share of work in the city, each group in its turn, even though they can still spend most of their time in each other's company in the clear air above? They can't possibly refuse. It's a just demand, and they are just people. But they will undoubtedly approach ruling, each one of them, as something unavoidable, just the opposite of the people who rule in every city at the moment. That's right, my friend. It's like this. If you can find a better life than ruling for the people who are going to be your rulers, then your well-governed city becomes a possibility. It will be the only city ruled by those who are truly rich, not rich in money, but in a good and wise life. The riches needed for good fortune. If you get beggars, people who are starved of good things in their own lives, going into public life because they believe that the good is something to be taken from there as plunder, then your city is not a possibility. Ruling becomes something to be fought over, and a war of this kind, domestic and internal, destroys both those involved in it and the rest of the city with them. Very true, he said. All right, then. Can you think of any life, apart from the life of true philosophy, which has a contempt for public office? Good heavens, no. But ruling must be courted only by those who are not in love with her. Otherwise, they will have rival suitors to contend with. Of course. And if you're going to compel people to enter upon the guardianship of the city, who better than those who are wisest in these matters, in what will give the city the best government, and who have their own rewards and their own way of life, better than the political? There is no one better, he said. Very well, Glaucon. The agreed characteristics of the city which is to reach the peak of political organisation are community of women, community of children and the whole system of education, community likewise of everyday life, both in wartime and peacetime, and the kingship of those among them who have developed into the best philosophers, and the best when it comes to war. Yes, he said, those are the agreed characteristics. What is more, we also agreed that when the rulers assume power, they will take the soldiers and move them to housing of the kind we described earlier, common to all of them, and offering no private property to anyone. And in addition to the nature of their housing, we even reached agreement, if you recall, on the kind of possessions they will have. I do recall. We thought that none of them should have any of the possessions which most people nowadays have. They should be guardians and warrior athletes of some sort, receiving from the rest of the citizens, as annual pay for their guardianship, just as much maintenance as they need for this purpose. Their duty would be to protect themselves and the rest of the city. You're right, I said. But after we'd finished dealing with all that, can we remember the point where we began this digression, so that we can carry on from the same place? That's easy enough, he said. You were talking in pretty much the way you're talking now, as if you had completed your account of the city. You were saying you regarded the kind of city you had just described, and the individual who resembled it, as a good one, despite the fact that you apparently had an even better city and individual to tell us about. You certainly said that if this was the right sort of city, then the others must have something wrong with them. And you said, if I remember rightly, that there were four other kinds of regime, or four others worthy of discussion at any rate. You said we should look at their faults and at the individuals who resemble them, so that when we had examined all the individuals and reached agreement on which was the best and which was the worst, we could ask whether the best individual is the happiest and the worst the most wretched, or whether that's all a mistake. I asked you which four regimes you meant, but then Polymarchus and Adeimantus interrupted, and that started you on the discussion which has brought you here. What an excellent memory. In that case, try and give me the answer you were going to give me then. Certainly, I said, assuming I can, that is. Apart from anything else, I have reasons of my own for wanting to know which four regimes you meant. There will be no difficulty in telling you that. They even have names, the ones I'm talking about. There's the one which is pretty generally approved, the Cretan or Spartan. Next, and next in the scale of general approval, is the one called oligarchy, a form of government filled with all sorts of evils. In contrast to oligarchy, and the form of government which in turn arises out of it, is democracy. And then there is the wonderful institution of tyranny, standing head and shoulders above all the others, the fourth and last diseased state of the city. Can you think of any other kind of regime which forms a distinct category of its own? I take it that hereditary rule by families, kingships which go to the highest bidder, and other similar regimes, which you will find are no less common among the barbarians than among the Greeks, are all intermediate between the forms I have mentioned. Yes, he said, we certainly do hear about plenty of extraordinary regimes. Well then, are you aware that for individuals also there must necessarily be as many kinds of character as there are kinds of regime? Or do you think that regimes somehow come into being from oak or stone? Isn't it rather from the characters of people in the city, which tip the scale, as it were, taking the rest with them? No, I think it's entirely the character of the inhabitants. In which case, if there are five types of city, then for individuals there will likewise be five dispositions of the soul. Of course. Well, we have finished describing the person who resembles aristocracy, and we say quite rightly that he is good and just. Yes, we have described him. Is the next thing, then, to describe the ones who are less good, the lover of victory and honour, who corresponds to the Spartan regime, and then in turn the oligarchic character, the democratic, and the tyrannical? That way we can contrast the most unjust, when we find him, with the most just. Our investigation into how pure justice fares, relative to pure injustice, in terms of the happiness or wretchedness of the person who possesses it, will be complete. And we can either follow Thrasymachus's advice and pursue injustice, or follow the argument which is unfolding before us now, and pursue justice. Yes, he said, that's exactly what we have to do. All right, then. Shall we start by taking a look at the honour-loving regime Timocracy, or Timarchy, followed by Oligarchy? After that, we can turn to Democracy, and fourthly, we can turn to the city which is ruled by a tyrant, and look at that. Will that be a way of trying to become competent judges of the question we have asked ourselves? It would certainly be a logical way of going about our observations and judgments. Very well. Let's try and describe the way in which timocracy might arise out of aristocracy. Is it a general rule that the cause of change in any regime is to be found in the sovereign body itself, when civil war arises within this group? That as long as this group, however small it may be, remains united, it is impossible for the regime to be altered? Yes, that's true. In that case, Glaucon, how will the regime of our city be altered? How will civil war break out, either between our auxiliaries and our rulers, or among them? Do you want us, like Homer, to invoke the Muses to tell us how first dissension fell upon them? Shall we imagine that they speak to us in high-flown, tragic tones, as if they were playing with little children and teasing them by pretending to be speaking seriously? What would they say? Something like this. It is no easy matter for a city founded in this way to be altered, but since destruction awaits everything that has come to be, even a foundation of this kind will not survive for the whole of time. It will fall apart, and this will be the manner of its falling. Both for plants in the ground and for animals above the ground, it is a fact that souls and bodies are produced or not produced when the cycles of begetting for each species complete their revolutions. Short revolutions for short-lived species, and the opposite for long-lived species. In the case of your species, wise though the people you have educated as leaders of the city are, still they will not quite hit the mark when they apply calculation, together with observation, to their programme of breeding and birth control. Success will elude them, and they will sometimes produce children they should not produce. When your guardians make injudicious unions of brides and grooms, the children will not have the right nature, and they will not be fortunate. The previous generation will select the best of them, but they will not deserve selection. And when they in their turn inherit the powers of their fathers, the first thing they will neglect as guardians will be us, the muses, since they will put too low a value on musical and literary education. And the second thing they will neglect will be physical education. The result will be a younger generation which has even less regard for us. And from their number, rulers will be appointed who completely lack a guardian's ability to discriminate between Hesiod's classes, or the classes in your city, gold, silver, bronze, and iron. When iron is compounded with silver, and bronze with gold, then you will get unlikeness and discordant inequality. And when you get those, wherever they occur, they always breed war and hostility. This is sedition's noble line, we have to say, always, and wherever it arises. What else do the muses have to say? When civil war breaks out, the classes or natures are divided into two. The iron and bronze draw the state towards commerce and the possession of land and housing of gold and silver. The other pair, by contrast, the gold and silver, lead the state towards virtue and traditional order. In fighting and struggling against one another, they arrive at a compromise. The land and housing is to be divided up and owned privately, and they agree to enslave those who were previously watched over by them as free men, friends and providers. They now hold them as serfs and slaves, while their role is to watch them and conduct warfare. "Yes," he said, "I think that is the origin of this sort of change." "In which case," I said, "would this regime be a kind of halfway house between aristocracy and oligarchy?"
"It certainly would."
"Very well. Will the points it has in common with the original regime be these? Respect for the rulers, the disqualification of the warrior element in the state from agriculture, manual employment, or any other kind of business? The establishment of communal living quarters, and the concentration on physical education and training for war."
"Yes."
"Whereas fear of putting the wise into positions of power, since the wise men it has are now complex, not simple and direct any more, a leaning towards people who are spirited, more straightforward and naturally cut out for war rather than peace, the value it places on military deceptions and stratagems, the way it spends its entire time at war, will most of these characteristics be peculiar to itself?"
"Yes."
"Now that they possess their own treasuries and strong rooms where they can put their gold and silver and keep it hidden, people like this will be avaricious, like the members of an oligarchy, with a fierce and secret passion for gold and silver. And to protect it all, they will have walls around their houses, real private nests where they can spend a fortune on women or anyone else they fancy."
"Very true," he said.
"The value they put on money and their inability to acquire it openly will make them mean with their own money, while their desires and the secret pleasures they enjoy will make them extravagant with other people's. They will run away from the law like children running away from their father, since their education will not have been a matter of conviction, but something imposed on them by force. This, in turn, is the result of neglecting the true muse, the muse of argument and philosophy, and setting a higher value on physical education than on education in the arts."
"It's certainly a mixed regime you are describing, partly bad and partly good."
"Yes, it is a mixture," I said, "but it has one striking characteristic which comes from the dominance of the spirited element, love of victory and honour."
"Absolutely."
"So much for this regime, then. That's how it would have come into existence, and that's what it would be like. It's just an outline sketch of the regime without filling in the details, but even a sketch will give us a good enough picture of the completely just man and the completely unjust man. It's an impossibly long task to describe every regime and every character without leaving anything out."
"Quite right," he said. I imagine the next regime would be oligarchy, the regime based on property qualifications, where the rich rule and the poor man is excluded from power. Do we have to explain how the change from timarchy to oligarchy first takes place? Yes. The regime we described is destroyed by the strong room full of gold which each man possesses. They start by inventing extravagances for themselves, and this leads them to bend the laws, since neither they nor their wives are prepared to obey them. That's likely enough. The next step, I suppose, will have been for them to start eyeing one another and competing with one another, and in this way they would reduce the whole population to their own level. Very likely. After that, presumably, they would become still further involved in making money, and the higher the value they put on that, the lower the value they would put on virtue. Isn't virtue always at odds with wealth in this way? As if they were in the two scales of a balance, always trying to move in opposite directions. Exactly, he said. And as wealth and the wealthy are more valued in a city, so goodness and the good are valued less. Obviously. What is valued at any particular time becomes the common practice. What is not valued is neglected. Yes. Eventually, then, they stop being competitive and ambitious and become mercenary and money-loving. They praise and admire the rich man and admit him to positions of power. The poor man they treat with contempt. Absolutely. At that point, they pass a law defining the oligarchic regime. They establish a wealth qualification, larger in an extreme oligarchy, smaller in a more moderate oligarchy, and declare that anyone whose property does not reach the prescribed value is debarred from the government. Either they put this into effect by force of arms, or else they've already established this kind of regime earlier by intimidation. Isn't that how it's done? It is. So that, more or less, is how it becomes established. Yes, he said. But what are the characteristics of this regime, and what are the kind of faults we said it possessed? Well, I said, the first fault is this very thing which defines its nature. Think what it would be like if you appointed ship's captains in this way, on the basis of a property qualification, and refused a command to a poor man, even if he was better qualified. I think it would be a sorry voyage they'd find themselves making, he said. And the same with any position of command over anything. That's certainly my opinion. With the exception of a city, or including a city. It is especially true of a city, he said, since the responsibility a city brings is the greatest and the most demanding. This would be one great failing, then, possessed by oligarchy. It looks like it. What about its second failing? Is that any less serious? What would it be, this second failing? That a city of this kind is bound to be two cities, not one. A city of the poor and a city of the rich, living in the same place but constantly scheming against one another. That is, God knows, as big a failing as the first. You must ask yourself, however, if this city isn't also the first to introduce an evil which is greater than either of these. What evil is that? There is nothing to stop one person selling all his property, and a second person acquiring it. Nothing to stop the first person still living in the city after selling his property without being one of the elements which make up the city. He is neither businessman nor skilled worker, neither cavalryman nor infantryman, just a poor man, what they call a man without means. Yes, he said, this city is the first to introduce this evil. Certainly, in cities with oligarchic regimes, this kind of thing is not prohibited in any way. If it were, you wouldn't get one group of people who were very rich and the rest living in complete poverty. That's right. And here's another point to think about. At the point where someone like this was rich and spending all his money, was he even at that time any use to the city for the purposes we've been talking about? Or was it an illusion, his being one of the rulers? Was he in truth neither a ruler nor a servant of the city, but merely a spendthrift? Yes, he said, it was an illusion. He was nothing more than a spendthrift. Do you want us to say, then, that just as a drone born in a cell is a blight on the hive, so a man like this is born as a drone in a household and as a blight on the city? By all means, Socrates. Well, then, Adamantus, is it the case that God has made the winged variety of drone all stingless, whereas of these two-legged drones, some are stingless, but others have very nasty stings? Do those who finish up as beggars in their old age come from the stingless class, and all those who are labelled criminals come from the class with stings? Yes, that's true, he said. It's obvious, then, that anywhere in a city you see beggars, there you can expect to find a secret nest of thieves, pickpockets, robbers of temples, and all these sorts of malefactors. Yes, that's obvious. And don't you find beggars in cities with oligarchic regimes? Yes, practically the whole population apart from the rulers. Can we avoid the conclusion, then, that in these cities there is a large number of criminals with stings, and that the authorities systematically and forcibly keep them under control? No, we can't, he said. And can we not say that the cause of people like this coming into existence there is lack of education, together with poor upbringing and constitutional arrangements? Yes, we can. Well, that's roughly what the oligarchic city would be like, and those are the evils it would contain, plus some others besides, perhaps. Yes, that's about it. Then that's another regime we can regard as dealt with, the one known as oligarchic, whose rulers are chosen on the basis of a property qualification. Democracy would seem to be our next object of inquiry. How it arises and what it is like when it does arise. Isn't the way a city changes from oligarchy to democracy something like this? Isn't it the result of their greed in pursuing the ideal they have set themselves, the requirement to become as rich as possible? How do you mean? Well, the reason the rulers in it are rulers, I take it, is because of their great wealth. So, if any of the young turn out to have no self-restraint, the rulers, predictably, are not prepared to restrain them by a law prohibiting them from spending what they own and losing it all. Their aim is to buy up the property of people like this, or lend them money with the property as security, and in this way become even richer and more highly respected. Yes, that is their overriding aim. And isn't it obvious by now in a city that a high regard for wealth is incompatible with the possession of self-discipline on the part of the citizens? They will inevitably lose interest in one or the other. Yes, that's reasonably clear, he said. So, through negligence and the consistent license they give well-born individuals to behave without restraint, the rulers in oligarchies can sometimes drive them into poverty. They certainly can. And these people, I take it, sit around armed in the city, in debt, or disfranchised, or both. They are the drones with stings, eager for revolution. They hate and plot against those who now possess their property, and the others like them. True. And presumably, the city turns into a democracy when the poor are victorious, when they kill some of their opponents and send others into exile, give an equal share in the constitution and public office to those who remain, and when public office in the city is allocated for the most part by lot. Yes, he said, that is the way democracy becomes established, whether it happens by force of arms or because their opponents lose their nerve and go into exile. Very well, then. What will this regime, in its turn, be like? How will these people live? Aren't they free men, for a start? Isn't it a city full of freedom and freedom of speech? Isn't there liberty in it for anyone to do anything he wants? Yes, that's the reputation it has, he said. And where there is liberty, then obviously each person can arrange his own life within the city in whatever way pleases him. Obviously. The most varied of regimes, I would think, as far as human character goes. Of course. It's probably the most attractive of the regimes, I said. Like a coat of many colours, with an infinite variety of floral decoration. So this regime will catch the eye with its infinite variety of moral decoration. Lots of people are likely to judge this regime to be the most attractive, like women or children looking at prettily painted objects.
Indeed they will.
There's no compulsion to hold office in this city, I said, even if you're well qualified to hold office, nor to obey those who do hold office if you don't feel like it, nor to go to war when the city is at war, nor to be at peace when everyone else is, unless peace is what you want. Then again, even if there's a law stopping you holding office or being a member of a jury, there's nothing to stop you holding office and being a member of a jury anyway, if that's how the mood takes you. Isn't this, in the short term, a delightful and heaven-sent way of life?
It probably is, in the short term.
And what about the relaxed attitude of those sentenced by the courts? Isn't it civilized? Or have you never seen people who have been condemned to death or exile in a regime of this sort, who nonetheless remain in person, hanging about at the centre of things and haunting the place, like the spirit of a departed hero, without anyone caring or noticing?
I've seen plenty, he said.
Then there's the tolerance of this city. No pedantic insistence on detail, but an utter contempt for the things we showed such respect for when we were founding our city. Our claim that only someone with an outstanding nature could ever turn out to be a good man, and only if from earliest childhood he played in the best company and the right surroundings and did all the right kinds of things. How magnificently the city tramples all this underfoot, paying no attention to what kind of life someone led before he entered political life. All anyone has to do to win favour is say he is a friend of the people. Ah, yes, that's true nobility. These and related qualities will be the ones possessed by democracy. You'd expect it to be an enjoyable kind of regime, anarchic, colourful, and granting equality of a sort to equals and unequals alike.
Yes, that's a pretty familiar story, he said.
In that case, I said, that leaves us with the task of describing the most delightful of regimes and the most delightful of individuals. Tyranny and the tyrant.
It certainly does, he said.
Does tyranny arise out of democracy much the same way as democracy arises out of oligarchy?
How do you mean?
The thing they held up as an ideal, I said, the thing which formed the basis of oligarchy, was wealth, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was the insatiable longing for wealth and the neglect of everything else in the pursuit of profit which destroyed oligarchy.
True, he said.
And is it the insatiable longing for what it defines as good which destroys democracy too in its turn?
What is it, you say, it defines as good?
Freedom, I said. This is the thing I imagine which in a democratic state you will hear described as its finest attribute, and what makes it, for any free spirit, the only place worth living in.
Yes, that is certainly something you often hear said.
Well then, as I was saying just now, is it the insatiable longing for this good and the neglect of everything else which brings about a change in this regime too, and creates the need for tyranny?
How does that happen? He asked.
I imagine it's when a democracy, in its thirst for the wine of freedom, finds the wine being poured by unscrupulous cupbearers, and when it drinks more deeply than it should of pure, unmixed freedom. Then, if its magistrates are not totally easygoing and do not offer it that freedom in large quantities, it accuses them of being filthy oligarchs and punishes them.
Yes, he said, that is what they do.
Those who obey the rulers are heaped with insults. They are regarded as servile non-entities. Praise and respect, whether in private or public life, go to rulers for behaving like those they rule, and to those they rule for behaving like rulers. Isn't the desire for freedom in a city of this type bound to run to extremes?
Of course it is.
And isn't the anarchy bound to make its way, my friend, into private households?
Can we give an example of that?
A father, for example, gets used to being like a child and being afraid of his sons. A son gets used to being like his father, He feels no respect or fear for his parents. All he wants is to be free. Immigrants are put on a par with citizens, and citizens with immigrants, and the same with visiting foreigners. Yes, that's what happens. That, plus a few more trivial examples of the same kind, I said. In a society of this sort, teachers are afraid of their pupils and curry favour with them. Pupils have an equal contempt for their teachers and their attendants. In general, the young are the image of their elders and challenge them in everything they say and do. The old descend to the level of the young. They pepper everything with wit and humour, trying to be like the young, because they don't want to be thought harsh or dictatorial. Precisely, he said. But the extreme limit of freedom in a city of this kind comes when those who have been bought as slaves, whether male or female, are every bit as free as those who bought them. As for the relationship of women to men and men to women, I all but forgot to mention the extent of the legal equality and liberty between them. To generalise from all these collected observations, have you noticed how sensitive it makes the souls of the citizens, so that if anyone seeks to impose the slightest degree of slavery, they grow angry and cannot tolerate it? In the end, as I imagine you are aware, they take no notice even of the laws, written or unwritten, in their determination that no one shall be master over them in any way at all. Yes, I'm well aware of that, he said. This is the form of government, my friend, so attractive and so headstrong, from which I believe tyranny is born. Certainly headstrong, he said, but what is the next step? We mentioned the class of idle and extravagant men, the most courageous element leading, the least courageous element following. We compared them to drones, the leaders to drones with stings, the followers to drones without stings. Rightly so. Very well. Let's make a theoretical division of the democratic city into three parts. After all, this is how it is, in fact, composed. This class of drones, I imagine, is one part, and because of the absence of restrictions, it grows at least as freely in a democracy as in an oligarchy. That is so. But it is much fiercer in a democracy than in an oligarchy. In what way? In an oligarchy, it is treated as of no value and excluded from power. So it gets no exercise and does not develop its strength. In a democracy, by contrast, barring a few individuals, it is the dominant influence in the state. The fiercest element in this class does the talking and acting. The remainder sit around the rostrum, buzzing and refusing to allow the expression of any other view. The result is that in a regime of this kind, everything, with very few exceptions, is run by the class of drones. Exactly, he said. Then there's a second class, which always separates itself off from the majority. What class is that? When everyone is engaged in making money, presumably it is those with the most disciplined temperament who generally become the richest. Very likely. They provide a plentiful supply of honey for the drones, I imagine, and an easy source from which to extract it. Yes, he said. After all, they can't extract much from those who haven't got much. They're called the rich, these people we're talking about, the drones' feeding ground. That's about it, he said. The general populace would be the third class, manual labourers with little interest in politics and very little property of their own. This is the most numerous and powerful class in a democracy, but only when it is assembled together. It is indeed, he said, but if it isn't getting some share of the honey, it is reluctant to assemble very often. That's why it always does get a share of it, if its leaders have anything to do with it. They take it away from those who possess property and distribute it among the people, keeping only the lion's share for themselves. Yes, the people do get a limited share of that sort, he said. Those whose property is taken away are presumably compelled to defend themselves by speaking in the assembly and taking whatever other action they can. Of course, even if they have no desire at all for revolution, they are accused by the others of plotting against the people and being oligarchs. Naturally. In the end, when they see the people attempting to injure them, not maliciously, but out of ignorance, misled by their opponents, at that point, whether they like it or not, the rich really do become oligarchs, though not from choice. This, too, is an evil implanted in them by the stings of the drone we were talking about.
It is indeed.
Then you get impeachments, litigation, and lawsuits between the two classes.
You certainly do.
And isn't there a universal tendency for the people to set up one single individual who is their own particular champion? Don't they feed him up and make him mighty?
They do.
So, when we look at the growth of a tyrant, I said, one thing at least is clear. This position of champion is the sole root from which the tyrant springs.
Yes, that's absolutely clear.
In that case, what prompts the change from champion to tyrant? Isn't it pretty obvious that it happens when the champion of the people starts acting like the character in the story about the temple of Zeus, the wolf god in Arcadia?
What story? He asked.
That there is one piece of human innards chopped up among all the pieces of the other sacrificial offerings, and that anyone who tastes it will inevitably turn into a wolf. Or haven't you heard that story?
Yes, I have heard it.
Isn't it the same with a champion of the people? Once he really wins the mob over, the blood of his kinsmen is no bar to him. He accuses someone falsely, as such people do. He brings him to trial and murders him, and as he rubs out a man's life, his unholy mouth and lips taste the blood of a butchered kinsman. He drives people into exile or kills them, hinting at a cancellation of debts and the redistribution of land. What is the inevitable and predestined next step for someone like this? Doesn't he either have to be destroyed by his enemies or else become tyrant, turning from man into wolf?
Yes, that is absolutely inevitable, he said.
He becomes the architect of civil war against those who own property.
He does.
Well then, if he's sent into exile but returns despite his enemies, doesn't he return as an out-and-out tyrant?
Yes, obviously.
And if his enemies are unable to drive him into exile or kill him by attacking him publicly, then they start plotting to kill him secretly, by assassination.
Yes, that's certainly what tends to happen, he said.
The tyrant's response to this is the famous request which everyone who has reached this stage discovers. He asks the people for a personal bodyguard to guarantee the safety of their people's champion.
Indeed, he does.
And they give him one. More worried about his safety than their own, presumably.
Much more.
Shall we then describe the happiness of this man and of the city where such a creature comes into being?
By all means, let's describe it, he said.
Very well. To start with, in the early days, doesn't he have a smile and a friendly word for everyone he meets? He says he's no tyrant and is full of promises both to individuals and to the state. Won't he have freed them from their debts and divided up the land among the people and among his supporters? Doesn't he pretend to be universally kind and gentle?
He's bound to.
But I imagine that once he feels safe from his enemies in exile, being reconciled with some and destroying others, his first concern is to be constantly starting wars, so that the people will stand in need of a leader.
Very likely.
And, perhaps, with the further intention that their contributions to the war will impoverish them, compel them to concentrate on their daily occupations, and make them less likely to plot against him.
Undoubtedly.
And if there are some independent-minded people whom he suspects of challenging his rule, doesn't he try to find a good excuse for handing them over to the enemy and destroying them? For all these reasons, isn't a tyrant always bound to be stirring up war?
Yes, he is.
Doesn't this tend to make him increasingly unpopular with the citizens?
Of course it does.
Then the boldest of those who help to make him tyrant, and who are now in positions of power, start to speak their minds freely, don't they? Both to him and to one another, criticising what is going on.
Probably.
So the